I'm Julie Balmer, and in 2003, my sister gave birth to, it was an unplanned pregnancy, and she gave birth to a little boy. After he was born, he had a collapse, took him into the ER. They immediately diagnosed it as child abuse. And because I was being the primary caretaker, I turned myself in at their request. But in 2005, I was convicted, and I was sentenced 10 to 15 years.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the story of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Hear the heartbreaking, true accounts of those who have been wrongly convicted and then are proven innocent. Thanks for joining us.
The criminal justice system works to keep people safe and make sure the bad guys go to prison. But what if someone who has been convicted of a crime isn't actually guilty?
It's why shows like Making a Murderer have been such a hit with audiences lately, and sadly, false convictions happen more than you'd think. Like from Julie Balmer from Warren. Julie adopted her baby nephew out of the goodness of her heart back in 2003.
After taking him to the hospital when he wouldn't eat, Julie was accused of child abuse, of shaking the baby. She was later convicted of that crime and started serving 15 years in prison. Stories like Julie's bring into question what we thought we knew about the criminal justice system.
Julie Balmer thought she was doing the right thing when she agreed to adopt her nephew Philip. His mother, her sister, was unable to care for him because of a substance abuse issue. That was a very responsible and noble choice for Julie to make. And I told her as much.
When you say that, it's real foreign. It's like almost, but God bless you, I guess. I don't see it as being anything great and wonderful. It's just you do what you have to do. I think even when Victoria told me, you know, she said this was an unplanned pregnancy, I was attacked, I don't want to keep the baby. But Victoria said, they're not candy bars, you just don't give them away.
After taking over guardianship of Philip, Julie's life changed forever, but not in the way she expected. You're listening to Episode 3 of Actual Innocence, and here's Julie's story.
We were average middle-class Catholic family, good wholesome, going to church every Sunday. You know, my father had the 9-to-5. My mother was a homemaker. I had 4 sisters and 1 brother. My mother had 2 sets of twins. My younger sister, her twin brother, passed a few days after birth. We were all close, you know, within 4 years. You know, my older sisters are 4 years older than myself, 5 years older than my younger sister. You know, we were just an average family. Average quarrels and average everything. My 2 older sisters married, and, you know, they started their families quite young, literally at 18 for one and 19 for the other. So, and they have 9 children between the 2 of them. So I became an aunt very early on. I had no issues with them having children or babies around me. Victoria, you know, she had a son prior to giving birth to Philip, whom at the time I was co-raising because of her addiction at the time.
I asked Julie how Philip, her sister's biological son, came to be in her care.
It was an unplanned pregnancy, and she gave birth to a little boy that she was unable to care for. So with the blessing of my family, we arranged an in-family adoption. He had a difficult birth. An early birth, an induced birth. Well, 6 weeks after he was born, he had a collapse, if you will. That's the terminology that they used.
Julie went on to tell me about the experiences resulting in Philip's hospitalization.
When Philip was born, he was put into the neonatal intensive care unit for a week. They didn't release him for a week. And I didn't have any legal say about what was happening because the adoption hadn't gone through yet. And I was just getting a lot of information secondhand from my sister. And I was told that he couldn't come home because he had acid reflux. After he did come home, they told me that he had to be on a very, very, very strict feeding schedule. You know, every 2 hours, 3 to 4 ounces. So I went ahead and I set the alarm on my phone for every 2 hours. And that was his little feeding schedule. But he stopped feeding for me that Thursday evening. I was getting ready to get him baptized, and so we were going to baptismal classes at St. Peter's, and we would meet with Father Cooney. And so I went ahead, and Father Cooney actually told me, he's not looking too good. And I'm like, and this was Father Cooney's 3rd time seeing him. And so I said, well, what do you mean he's not looking too good? I said, he just doesn't look good. He looks like he's pale or something. So I said, when I get home, I said, I'll take his temperature. So when I got home and started readying him for bed and whatnot, he refused his bottle. He didn't want his bottle. And I was like, that's interesting. He wasn't shy about taking the bottle. He wasn't a vigorous eater. You know, it was more like, meh, okay, whatever. I was trying to get a decent feeding down him for most of the night. And by midnight, I was about to just give up and let the poor guy, you know, just stay asleep because I kept waking him up. To try to, you know, have him take some feeding. And so, around, it was a little after midnight, he actually did take some bottle, and then he didn't want any more. And when I put him over my shoulder to, you know, to burp him, he threw up. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe you do have like a little cold coming on. You know, of course I had, you know, those parent manuals and, you know, what to do, tempered bath. And then, so I followed what the book said, and in the morning, because mind you, it was around midnight, in the morning, I called my father around 8:30, 9 o'clock, and I told him, I said, yeah, Phillip's, you know, come down with something, and I explained everything. And so he said, well, why don't you give his pediatrician a call? It wouldn't hurt to do that, you know, just to see what she suggests. Maybe she can, you know, maybe she'll want you to come in. So when I told her that he hadn't kept a feeding down in 12 hours, then she went ahead and she said, well, why don't you take him to the ER so that they can start an IV because we're concerned about him losing fluids and, or, you know, being dehydrated. They want to get some fluids in him. Well, I did. I took him into the ER. And then about an hour after being there, they couldn't determine what was going on. Of course, he had no external injuries or anything, and that they wanted to transport him to Children's Hospital. And Victoria, you know, still being the legal parent, signed the forms to release him to Children's Hospital. And when we got there, you know, it was another bunch of waiting. And probably about 11 p.m., the doctor came out and said, you know, there's really nothing we can do right now because we're waiting on test results. So that she said, you know, this has been a hard day for all of you. He's stabilized. He's resting. Everybody's happy. Everybody's fine. Guys, go home and come back tomorrow morning. So we all went home and then went back Saturday morning, stayed most of the day, still waiting on results. You know, they were ruling things out and whatnot. One of the nurses was doing her routine measurements and the weighing of the infants and noticed that my nephew, his head had grown considerably larger than the night before. They took MRI and CAT scans and saw that there was bleeding and that he also had detached retinas and bleeding behind, you know, in that area and whatnot. So, of course, in the medical field, at some point they're taught, you know, about, you know, to look out for signs for the supposed, you know, hypothesis of, you know, baby shaken syndrome, if you will. So, of course, with Phillip having no external injuries, but the bleeding in the brain and then behind the eyes and whatnot, they immediately diagnosed it as child abuse. And because I was the last person to be with him and being the primary caretaker, I immediately was the one in the hot seat, if you will.
Shaken baby syndrome is defined by the National Institute of Neurological Disorders as a type of inflicted traumatic brain injury that happens when a baby is violently shaken. A baby has weak neck muscles and a large, heavy head. Shaking makes the fragile brain bounce back and forth inside of the skull and causes bruising, swelling, and bleeding, which can lead to permanent severe brain damage or death. The characteristic injuries of shaken baby syndrome are bleeding in the brain, bleeding behind the retinas, damage to the spinal cord and neck, and fractures to the ribs and bones. These injuries may not be immediately noticeable. Symptoms of shaken baby syndrome include extreme irritability, poor feeding, breathing problems, convulsions, vomiting, and pale or bluish skin. Shaken baby injuries usually occur in children younger than 2 years old. It was not long after Phillip received this diagnosis that Julie was contacted by law enforcement.
After we left the hospital on Friday evening, Victoria did an MIA. She just disappeared. Figured that she had relapsed. And if you I have a, if you know an addict or if you know somebody close to an addict because they're family or whatnot, you always dread that phone call. And I thought, oh my gosh, here it is. Like, this is something that we really need now. And they asked if I would come in, and I asked them what this was in regards to. And they said they couldn't talk to me over the phone, that they needed me to come in. And so I asked them, I said, is this in regards to my sister, Victoria? Is she alive? Or, like, what am I coming in for? I need to be prepared. I need to know what I'm coming into. And they said, this has nothing to do with your sister, but we need you here immediately. So I went immediately. like a layperson that puts your faith in, you know, law enforcement. Yeah. They're supposed to be there to protect you. I was pretty naive, I guess, because my mind was focused on Victoria, and I didn't understand. They immediately started talking about Philip, and I didn't understand why they were talking about Philip, because in my mind, I really had it there that I was there for Victoria, and so I kept questioning them. Why are you worried about Philip? I was like, Philip is in a hospital right now, okay? I was like, he's fine, but he's not fine. I was like, I'm asking you about my sister. And then they were like, we're asking you about Philip. And I'm like, why are you concerned about Philip? I'm concerned about my sister who's been gone for 2 days. And so we were butting heads like that. I don't know. It was probably 20, 25 minutes into it. The light popped on. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I thought to myself, these people think Philip's been injured or, like, abused. And they think I did something. And so I asked. I outright asked them, I said, what are you guys getting at? What's going on? And then they said, well, we believe, you know, we have evidence that your nephew's been shaken and you were the primary caregiver and you're the last person with him and you took him into the hospital. So we have every reason to suspect that you did this. And at that point, I clammed up. They actually used that against me at my second trial. So I was very offended. It wasn't like, hey, you just offered me a piece of cherry pie and told me that Victoria's good and Philip's good. You're sitting up here and now you're insulting me. So the first time I was there for about maybe an hour. The second time, at the end of it, I actually insisted on a lie detector. So they scheduled that for me like 2 or 3 days later. And then that part of it, that was like 4 hours, and that was grueling because, I mean, I didn't expect that type of experience. In fact, I remember even after leaving, I called up the detective and I was like, you should have prepared me for that. I was like, you don't just have somebody staring at a wall for 4 hours. I was like, you're acting like I'm some major criminal. And he was like, well, yeah, you are a criminal. You abused your nephew. And I'm like, you know, the audacity, you know.
Yeah,
so then
yeah.
he said, we'll call you with the results. And they went ahead and they called me back and they claimed I failed it. I said, well, I want to take it again. They denied that. And then they brought this female officer in, and she was like a little rough and tough, if you will. And I guess they thought that she was going to, like, psychologically break me down or scare me or something, because they did, like, the good cop, bad cop. I remember she went ahead and she came in and she was like, got right in my face, how dare, like some drill sergeant, how dare you, were you doing that to that poor baby? That poor kid, I can't even believe that kid's alive. All those busted bones and shattered ribs. And I looked at her and I said, excuse me. And I said, I'm not sure what file you have in your hand, but I can assure you whatever you're saying is not true, because I took my nephew into the hospital and he had not one injury. So whatever you're talking about, you've got the wrong file. And so it was like, that's when I knew, oh, they're doing the good cop, bad cop, and she was just trying to psychologically freak me out or something. I mean, I answered all of their questions, but I was rude about it. I was a little arrogant. So I was young and... After several interviews with the police, you know, I stood my ground. Then several months went by, several months, maybe 2 or 3, and then they called me in for another interview, and then they went ahead and in February, like the holidays had gone, and I just was like, okay, well, what's going on here? You know, why can't I get Philip back if they're not going to charge me? And I kept calling my adoption attorney, and, you know, he was the one keeping in contact with everybody. But then it was February the 4th, he gave me a call and he said, you have 48 hours. He was releasing himself from the case and that I needed to get myself a criminal defense attorney. The sheriff's department, they were charging me with first-degree child abuse. It became quite real in February of 2004 when I turned myself in at their request. Like any layperson that puts their trust in the criminal justice system and all of the professionals that are supposed to be protecting us and whatnot, I followed every order. I did everything that they told me to do.
Before we moved on with what happened in Julie's court proceedings, I needed to know what happened to Philip, the other victim, in this unfortunate circumstance.
I didn't realize the extent of the nightmare. Of course, the night Philip went into the hospital, and 2 days later, my realizing that he would not be coming home to me. He was in the hospital for several weeks. I took him in October. In December, they released him from the hospital to a foster family who was simply informed that there was a young infant who had been shaken and that his mother was a drug addict. And that's the only information that this family was given. When Philip was 6 months old, he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, and then within a matter of days, I received a letter that the family who had been fostering him wanted to adopt him, and that they had already relinquished the rights of my sister, and that because I was in the middle of criminal proceedings, or however it was worded, that pretty much I had no legal rights to stop the state adopting him out. And I wasn't even convicted yet. You know, he was like legally kidnapped. So that just shows that there's other flaws in parts of the government. I mean, it was just absolutely mind blowing. That's the heaviest cross that I'll always carry for the rest of my life. My nephew slash son was, you know, kidnapped. And there was nothing I or anybody in my family could do about it.
In my professional experience, children who are removed from their parents' custody are generally placed with suitable relatives, such as grandparents. I was curious as to why this was not the case in this situation.
When my parents initially requested taking Philip home from the hospital, the state wanted them both to sign a contract or an affidavit that they would not permit me or my sister Victoria to come into the house to have contact with any of us. Basically, they were like, if you take the kid, you can't have contact with Victoria or Julie in any form, in any motion, in any way. My father said, absolutely not. I'm not going to deny my daughter's entrance into my home. I'm not going to, you know, tell them they can't call me. Those are my daughters. Absolutely not. My sister from Florida, who was actually, you know, married with her children down there, and who was actually, ironically, a social worker for the state of Florida, got permission and her blessings from her husband to move up to Michigan, rent an apartment for the time that, as long as it was going to take, you know, for all the legal stuff to get by, and to care for Philip. And then again, they told her she had signed a similar form. Again, she said, I'm not going to deny my sisters. So that's why family couldn't take him.
Julie, after losing her son and being accused of child abuse, decided to retain an attorney to help her seek justice in the trial proceedings.
I retained an attorney. I got myself a bondsman and I retained an attorney. And so he told me that everything was going to cost probably about $2,500. And so I gave him $1,500 initially. And that, you know, I told him I would, you know, make a weekly or monthly payment. You know, then his fee went up to like $5,000 and then like $7,000. I was making decent money, but I was young and stupid. I shouldn't say it like that because I wasn't struggling. I just was very loose with my money, if you will. I didn't have a savings account with, you know, tons of money in there. And so when he started, you know, getting up and higher, I told him, I said, I can't afford much more. And so I think that's when he probably pretty much shut down. And I think that's why he didn't get the expert that I needed, you know, because I didn't have any money. At my evidentiary hearing to have my conviction overturned, he told the courts that he didn't know that he could request money from the courts in my defense. I think he was just like, oh, she ran out of money. I'm just going to do the least bit I need to do. So here's the funny thing. You know, he was, I don't know, he had to have been in his 40s or 50s, you know, been practicing law since graduating. But in my mind, I was young and arrogant. So I was like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm paying you. You work for me. You're going to do what you have to do to, you know, make sure I get the best defense. And that's the attitude I had with him. I mean, I wasn't sitting there barking orders at him, but I certainly let him know that you're here to protect me. Do your job. I remember asking if he was going to withdraw from the case after I couldn't afford anymore, but he said no. Probably been better if he had. I don't know, but he shut down on me. That's all I can say. He was like, well, she can't afford to pay me. I'm not going to do much for her. I mean, when you take the oath, right, that's what I'm thinking. But I guess mm-hmm. oaths don't mean anything. Dollar signs do.
Not being an attorney myself, I want us to check into the defense's ability to request funds to help cover expert witnesses and the likelihood that an attorney would be unaware of this fact. I consulted my friend from the Vanish podcast, who works as a paralegal, and she was able to send me two samples of this type of affidavit in less than a minute. I find it hard to believe that an experienced attorney would not have the knowledge or ability to submit such a request. I will be posting the examples on my website, www.actualininpod.com, under the Stories tab. Julie waited 18 months for her day in court, and this is how it went.
18 months, and it's the reason why so long went by is because the judge would write, you know, court order, like Philip's birth records, and then ironically that order would be missing. It just took that long because the hospital kept losing, ironically, these orders. And so my attorney would go pick up these records and they would say, well, we don't have evidence of this. And so he would literally have to go back to the judge. But of course, you just don't have that privilege of just going to the judge. You know, you have to file a reason why you want to be there and then get a date and da 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 da. We were always in court trying to get more paperwork or more orders or this or that. So that's why it took so long to actually get to the trial.
I asked Julie the basis for the prosecution's case and what evidence was presented. She told me it was solely based on the testimony of the two doctors that had examined Philip.
They had the two doctors that testified that that the bleeding in the brain was because he had been shaken. They said 24 to 48 hours prior to my bringing him initially into the hospital, which I took him initially into the hospital Friday around 11 a.m. And so, I called the pediatrician, had to wait for her call back. However, though, when the students at U of M were working on the case, preparing for the second trial, a group of them actually realized, well, my gosh, if it was 12 to 24 hours prior to my initially taking him to the hospital, somehow they went ahead and they realized, well, my gosh, he was actually in the hospital then during that time. So if it was 12 to 24 hours prior to him getting that measurement, when that nurse measured him, that was when the neurologist at the scan right. was like, hey, this kid was shaken, and it probably happened 12 to 24 hours ago. But he was in their care.
Julie then explained how her defense had worked.
Myself and my family, after the research that we did do, I remember Victoria, you know, his original due date was August the 28th. This was an unplanned pregnancy. It was an unwanted pregnancy because of the cause. Unfortunately, she was gang raped. And quite truthfully, she was an addict. She wanted to get back to her drugs. Probably around 6 or 7 months into her pregnancy, she was literally going to the hospital almost every week talking about, I'm in labor, I'm in labor. And her doctor was eventually told her, don't come back until your water breaks. For whatever reason, on August the 14th, around 11 p.m., she decided to take herself to the emergency room and complain of having flu-like symptoms. Her doctor was out of town, a one-year resident in the OBGYN area that opted to break her water and to induce the labor by use of Pitocin. She was in labor for 18 hours, and they gave her two doses of Pitocin. Pitocin is used to induce labor, but you only use it if it's 2 to 3 weeks after the original due date. And then why would they break her water? I mean, there were so many things that would just So my family and myself, we were like, that's the heart of my defense. He got cerebral palsy because of this Pitocin. So then that was like, we thought birth trauma was the heart of our defense. However, as much as we conveyed that to the attorney, like I said, he must have just, looking back on it, him shaking his head yes or no, he must have just really been zoning out and not even caring what we were saying, you know, after he realized we ran out of money. His opening statements, I realized I was screwed, because his last sentence during his opening statements, and he did it so dramatic, you know, like he thought he was somebody cool. He pointed at me and he was like, and this crime did not happen on her watch. What the hell is, what crime is there? Because nobody would ever tell me throughout that whole time. I kept saying, if I abused my nephew, tell me what I did. Tell me what your theory is. What were the mechanisms? This or that. I want to know what you're thinking. You're charging me with this. Tell me what I did. Tell me what you think I did. Nobody would ever tell me. He wouldn't let me testify because he told me, if the tone of your voice goes up one octave, I remember he said this, if it goes up one octave, the jury's going to look at you like you can't keep your temper.
It's heartbreaking to think that a woman who had taken in an unwanted child and cared for him like her own was now wrongly convicted for abusing him.
But in 2005, I was convicted, and I was sentenced 10 to 15 years. And it was 5 years later that I was able to retain, or not retain, because I didn't have any money, but I should say divine intervention brought several lawyers, several doctors, all pro bono, to share with the world that there was no crime committed, that simply a misdiagnosis.
I have to admit that I was a little skeptical going into this case. Since I can remember, I've been warned against and trained to look out for symptoms of shaken baby syndrome. However, a simple Google search has led me to a multitude of credible resources that lead me to believe that this is a diagnosis that is extremely controversial. Here is a clip from Fox 13 in Salt Lake City that gives an excellent explanation of the implications of this diagnosis in a trial.
Shaken baby syndrome has become very controversial in the legal field.
Carissa Bernhesick is a law professor at the University of Utah who's noticed a growing problem when it comes to shaken baby syndrome cases. Not everyone is so certain about the science behind them.
There's no doubt that child abuse is a real problem in this country, but it's also pretty clear that however the experts were originally being advised, they've since come to the conclusion that there's a lot more at play here than originally thought.
The thought now is that symptoms of shaken baby syndrome could also be caused by other injuries. And in March, the Washington Post reported that since 2001, more than 200 shaken baby syndrome cases were dropped, dismissed, or resulted in not guilty or overturned convictions.
The outcome in a trial is only as good as the evidence that goes into it. And if the medical community can't agree on what the medical evidence is, not sure how you'd necessarily expect a jury to.
Julie was granted an appeal based on the admission of new medical evidence that was not available in her original trial.
I had introduction of evidence, you know, my medical findings. However, when I first appealed, and I appealed immediately, by law, you know, I'm allowed a court-appointed attorney to help the initial appeal. I kept telling her, listen, my attorney never brought up birth trauma during the whole trial, and I'm telling you, my nephew was injured during birth. His injuries are from birth. It wasn't until the doctors on the second trial did their research and their findings that I found out, yeah, he actually had a stroke. I never knew that. I mean, that sort of like freaks me out, because when you hear stroke, you don't think of little five-week-old babies. She told me, no, we have to stick to the trial. If only there was an error during the trial, that's what I'm here for. We're prepping for my second trial. One of the attorneys told me she just wanted to be lazy or something, because not exclusively just for that. There's many reasons why. New evidence, new this, new that. I mean, it's not like, oh, we want a new trial because we think that you messed up during this one. There are errors during trials. One of the, in my appeals, were, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel, you know, because he blatantly just shut down on me.
I asked Julie how the U of M Innocence Clinic came to be involved in her case.
They opened up in 2009, and they're exclusively non-DNA. And, you know, I started appealing this in 2005. In 2007, September of 2007, I received that second letter from the state stating that I had been denied my second appeal. And, of course, I was indigent. I was exhausted. I had no, you know, I exhausted all my avenues. I didn't, of course, again, being a layperson, I wasn't aware of what's called a 6500 motion, which is introduction of new evidence. And so that's what my third appeal was based on, was my 6500, that motion that, you know, I was introducing new evidence to prove my innocence. But I didn't know, you know, what that was. When the initial attorney, Charles Lugosi, who was, he's formerly, you know, a professor from the University of, you know, the Ave Maria School of Law. I became a class project as a favor. And they just thought they were going to have fun with me. But the students found merit in the case, showed, you know, hey, this might be really something sincere, showed it to the dean, and he agreed to start funding it. But then after they started getting into it, they realized, hey, we really don't know what we're doing. We need some medical people, this and that. Ironically, Charles Lugosi, and this is when I say divine intervention probably really started kicking Fanny, because Charles Lugosi attended whatever dinner function he attended that evening, and seated at his table was Jack Kirkwood, who was from Seattle, who was attending the same function for whatever reason, and overheard Charles talking about this new case of, with this lady in prison being accused of shaken baby syndrome. And he looks at Charles and he's like, hey, my wife, you know, we live in Seattle, but she does pro bono work and she specializes in someone accused of this. So they exchanged information. And so Heather Kirkwood, based in Seattle, got involved, and then she's like, hey, I'm not local. We need to get some local people involved. So then they called up Carl Marlinga, and he was all about innocence cases. So he jumped on board. And then around that same time, the Michigan Innocence Clinic opened up. So Carl knew this and was like, hey, we got to get these people involved because this is right up their alley. I was number three for U of M. Yeah, so I'll have a lifetime commitment and relationship with them forever.
Julie was granted a second trial, and the new information presented discounted the previous doctor's testimonies that Philip had suffered from shaken baby syndrome.
Well, I was released from prison and then immediately put on bond because the state decided to recharge me after the courts overturned my conviction. That was December the 9th, 2009. When the state decided to retry me, I was recharged and rebooked and released on a tether and a bond. And 10 months later, I had the second trial. Came up during the second trial that when I originally took him into the hospital locally, the ER doctor did order an MIR and a CAT scan. And if that order had gone through, they would have seen that he was bleeding in the brain and they could have, oh my gosh, this kid is stroking. Therefore, give him some heparin or some other blood thinner, and I don't believe as much damage to his brain would have occurred. But, you know, he suffers from cerebral palsy now. He's almost 14 years old. So, unfortunately, that order was scratched when they decided to send him down to a children's hospital. That order actually should have followed him to the hospital, if not been taken care of before he even left. That's not something that I can ponder on because I don't have custody of Philip and that, but it's true. It was only during the second trial that they came up with some crazy theory that it was during the prosecutor's closing arguments was the first time I ever heard their theory, and I don't even know if it was their original theory, but it was something along the lines of I must have accidentally dropped Philip or something. And I must have freaked out, like, oh, my gosh, I hurt the baby. And I started shaking him to revive him. And that was their theory. And I remember even telling my attorney, I sort of nudged him. I was like, this is what they've been thinking for the past 7 years. Are you joking? And then it was October the 15th, 2010, that their jury came back that I wasn't guilty.
I wondered what Julie's life was like after her experiences with the justice system.
I'm very grateful for my faith. My faith is what keeps me standing, because otherwise I would have collapsed long ago. You know, it's been 6 years since I've been home, and I'm still adjusting. I'm still adjusting. Yeah. I'm still struggling in relationships. I'm still struggling with trust issues within my family, because I sort of felt like they abandoned me after I lost my second appeal. You know, my one sister, I used to receive, like my first year, I was receiving a letter or a picture or a card, at least from somebody in the family once a day. By my second year, it was like once a week. And then after I lost my second appeal, weeks would go by and I wouldn't hear from anybody. And I asked my father to confront my sister about that. And so she went ahead and she told him very bluntly and honestly, hey, you know, we're raising families. We can't be in prison with her. And countered with, hey, you're raising families. You got to go to, you know, the grocery store and feed them. Everybody stands in line at the grocery store. All you have to do is walk down the card aisle and pick out a card. You don't even have to put, you know, say anything. Just put it in the mail. At least I know that you're thinking of me. Because you can get some pretty crazy depressive thoughts when you're in that environment and you don't have, you know, you don't have people around you that you can trust and love and whatnot. And so yeah, I have some trust issues with my siblings right now that I'm working on. Gosh, like I said, it's been 6 years, but it's a struggle. Yeah. It's an absolute struggle. But I maintain and I just keep moving forward. Speaking about my wrongful conviction, educating the public, helping to spread awareness on, you know, the causes and effects and whatnot. That's very therapeutic for me. But I'm forever gonna be scarred, I think. Shy from my 40th birthday, and I tell you, some days it's harder to get out of bed, but you have to keep moving. That's all I can say. You know, I can't afford a breakdown. There isn't anybody to catch me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Actual Innocence. If you know an exoneree who would like to share their story, please contact me at actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. You can also check out the webpage for more information on the featured stories. This is Brooke. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to the Actual Innocence Podcast. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter at actualinpod. That's at actualinpod. Or search for our page on Facebook. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a good review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.